Okay, well, this, all these parts you know. This is what my name means, by the way. Marel means blackbird in Dutch. it's work where we'll discuss today is work done by my group, of course, my students. Molograaf has and Persoere have very important contributions. They are still in the middle of their work, not only on HTC, but he's doing other things, but both they are performing these very precise temperature-dependent ellipsometry experiments that will come in the second half of my talk. Gruninger wrote a cum laude PhD last year. He wrote a FET thesis, and some of you probably have it in your possession now. Then Tvetkov is a postdoc for several years. Dulich finished writing her thesis, and she will graduate in January, and that's more on the plasmon, Joseph plasmon story, in particular on the double plasmons. Then we wouldn't be able to do this work if we wouldn't have continuous collaborations with a large variety of crystal growers and thin film growers. Bernard Damm, for this work, made some very nice YBCO thin films, epitaxially. Cass and Manofsky together have been involved in growing bismuth 212 crystals. And also lanthanum, strontium, samarium, copper oxide crystals, Andreas Erb, YBCO. There are various other people, I sometimes forget a few, and then I'll just mention them during the talk. But I think for this talk, these four are the most important. The motivation of the work, well, the original motivation is actually the one that's somewhere in the middle, but I try to group them in a logical way, is to find, the motivation is that there are ideas floating around on HTC on how, certainly what the mechanism of through conductivity is. That's, of course, what one of the main questions. And some really interesting alternatives have been proposed, which I think in some cases, or in many of these cases, we are able to address experimentally and see whether or not they are correct. It started, this kind of work really started with testing the interlayer tunneling hypothesis, which was one of the types of models which said that superconductivity is caused by gain of kinetic energy rather than gain of interaction energy. There's quite a different model, but a similar characteristics by Hirsch, who's saying that pairing is caused also by decrease of kinetic energy. The difference mainly between these two types is this one was gain of kinetic energy perpendicular to the planes, this one is parallel to the planes. In one of the later, I think so far, unpublished ideas of Anderson, this is also still an option for the in-plane mechanism related to the RVB models. And then Kiffelsen, Emery, Zahn, and so they are not very outspoken on this issue, but if you probe them a little privately, they are willing to admit that probably this mechanism is a bit similar to the interlayer tunneling, except that it is something that happens in the planes between these one-dimensional stripe conducting paths.
I don't understand why John's name is associated with the
spin mechanism. Yes, Yang and Demler had a notion that they could come off of the high resonance as the main object and feed that back into the SI.
But it's so late.
This was not meant as a sociological review thing.
As long as Phil is open, the only thing I want to say is I'd like to believe that the middle one you have there can kind of cut both ways, only in the sense that J is T squared over U. Whether it's kinetic or potential.
Well, anyway, we have a way of
choosing which point to make, both of them.
I think that can at least be made clear from an experimental point of view by you, hopefully. You will have to make a choice there, because it should be related to a way of measuring this kinetic energy, and then, of course, you can also state which way it should go.
It's like a Florida election. I may want to recount.
Maybe I should not give the second half of my talk, because it gives the experiment. The BCS mechanism is a conventional story where pairing is actually caused by somehow gaining some interaction energy, but of course that's partly inhibited by an increase of kinetic energy, but not enough, otherwise it wouldn't form the superconducting state. Then there is an idea by Leggett. It's not orthogonal to any of these things, it's just slightly different. It's what he calls a mid-infrared mechanism, which means that somehow the pairing is caused by a decrease of Coulomb interaction energy, which is of course counterintuitive because Coulomb is repulsive. So how would you gain this by forming pairs? I don't know, but it can be measured partly. Then the scalloping and Zhang based on a spin mechanism, and again it's not orthogonal to any of the other ones, not in this direction, nor in that direction actually. But it's a directly testable idea, not with photons in this case, but with neutrons. So I won't talk about that particular one because I will only do the optical probes. Well, this is the only part where I will need a bit of blackboard. Condensation energy can be measured in high-TC superconductors also. It has been done in particular by Loram and Cooper and people in Cambridge. This is one example of out of many. These are the experimental data of the entropy as a function of temperature in optimally doped YBCO, and it's done via the route of specific heat measurements. This open area between the extrapolated normal state behavior and the superconducting state behavior, if you integrate that, that is the condensation energy. And I'm going to write a few things on the blackboard.
Is this the definition of the condensation energy that you'll be using?
That is actually, this is the definition of a condensation energy because it corresponds to the difference in total energy of the system at zero temperature if it were superconducting or normal.
See, between and if the normal state continues to behave
like the disaster.
Okay, there's always this problem, of course. On the other hand, okay, what can I say? I mean, they had a way, I didn't bring this transparency, but actually they, by considering different dopings and zinc dopings and things, they were able to establish that this line does seem to continue more or less like a straight line. There may be small deviations, of course. It wouldn't make any difference for the main principle, I think. Namely that the condensation energy should of course be a gain in energy, obviously. I mean, otherwise the system would certainly not be a superconductor. Now,
there is a switch right to your right, I think.
Yeah. There are, to get the correct picture for the behavior of the total energy gain, there are two ways that you can do it as a function of temperature. I'll plot here the behavior of the normal state kinetic energy first. At the superconducting point, if the thing goes superconducting in the BCS manner, the kinetic energy would actually go up a little bit. It would be a kink at this point and it would go higher than expected. The correlation energy or the interaction energy is something which has usually somewhat less strong temperature dependence, but what's most important is that this thing would maybe continue like a straight line, but now it drops more as it goes superconducting, and that means that so this difference here must exceed that difference, and it has a different sign. This is the conventional way of getting to that Loram picture, BCS I will call it, but it's not. Maybe other scenarios doing the same thing. But here's a completely different, a qualitatively different story, and that is that the kinetic energy would actually drop more, like this, as it goes superconducting, and the correlation energy could do anything, but presumably, I guess, one would believe that it's although it's not stated anywhere very precisely, but that it would actually increase a little bit if you go superconducting. But nevertheless, this extra drop of kinetic energy would then exceed the gain or increase of correlation energy. So this is anti-BCS. So it's SCS. So in terms of these earlier review of possible scenarios, the last two in any case would certainly be of the kind that you have on the right-hand side of the board. I think the first three would be like you have the left-hand side, but Doug already said maybe it's in between.
My impression is that in BCS theory, these two actually diverge
you know, by large amounts, and then there's a huge cancellation, and the condensation energy is actually a little tiny piece that
Well, I recently had a very similar discussion together with Dimitri and Lefri of the journal. It's true in the weak coupling limit. It wasn't, no, but it's probably some in the mind of many theoreticians.
Right, right.
If you take the, if you adopt BCS theory and you adopt the value of Gepford that we have for the, you know, you just do BCS as if it were applicable to high TC, is those parameters. They actually do not differ by. They are
more
not
like what you're drawing.
It's more like this, yeah. It's a factor of
large.
They're of equal magnitude.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, John, I think the large part you're remembering somehow is the kinetic energy. Of course, is huge.
Yeah.
The kinetic energy in the supernetting state is huge, and so there's a small difference between those.
Well, actually, what he's saying is actually correct, is actually correct always,
yeah.
Very close to TC. It's just that if you go, in this case, where apparently the coupling parameters are large, and you put in the numbers, then there are some logarithmic terms that normally would be unimportant become really important here. And the difference is not a factor, they're not equal, they differ by a factor of two or three or so.
Yeah. I mean, the comment is basically that the interaction energy, which is what you call the correlation energy, scales with the coupling constant, but the condensation energy, I think, has some weaker dependence on the attractive on the bare interaction parameter.
Yeah.
And so that there's a huge cancellation, you end up with a small condensation energy, and probably, like you said, just in weak coupling.
Just to be clear. Anyways, if you were right, it would in a way be better, because for us it would mean that all the signals that we're trying to nail down experimentally would be bigger, because we're taking it apart.
Right, yeah, you're looking at separate pieces.
It doesn't look, experimentally, it doesn't look like this optimistic scenario, unfortunately, but it would have some good promise for lower TC superconductors, which are closer to the decoupling limit, which might nevertheless have relatively large changes in these separate components. Yeah. Now, so now we get to the outline of the talk, actually. I will not talk here about most important properties. This is a transparency I used last week for a colloquium. You know all the properties. But so we have already done the proposed electronic mechanisms. Then we will talk about, now immediately we'll talk about, well, a few more remarks on this. Then we talk about optical spectroscopy of kinetic energy along the C direction, about changes of Coulomb energy and kinetic energy along the planes. These three, and I'll try to convey to you how we believe that we can measure these things separately. Well, of course, we all know what the kinetic energy part is. This was for this colloquium again, sorry for this, you know. Kinetic energy is the sum of all the independent electron kinetic energies if there are no interactions. Now we're talking about systems with interactions. And first of all, if the interactions would be weak, then you might still use a picture like this. I always use the colloquiums. It's the matrix model. Two electrons far away have some interaction with the polarizable environment, which gives them an energy gain minus 2 alpha m squared. But if they're on the same spot, it is minus alpha 2 m squared, and that gives you a gain of a factor of 2 in potential energy. It's a polaron picture. It's wrong, I know. So probably you have to do it the way it's done in the top. But anyways, that's what we usually think of as experimentalists when we think about pairing. A somewhat more elaborate way to do this, and that's, I think, rigorously correct now, but free for your observation on that point. If you have correlated electrons, two things change. First of all, the kinetic energy is not obtained anymore by a step function multiplied with the independent particle energies. If it's still a Fermi liquid, but still correlated, there's a small step here, but if it's not even a Fermi liquid, then it is just a broadened distribution function. For example, this broadening you find in the BCS state, which from this point of view doesn't look like a Fermi liquid anymore. The potential energy, or the correlation energy, is just given by the product of the pair correlation function and the interaction potential integrated over all coordinates of the system, including spin coordinates in principle. And this is thought to be a non-trivial function as soon as correlations emerge. Now, of course, already if you have just, even if you have a non-interacting electron gas, this function is a highly non-trivial function because of the Pauli principle. It's not flat, it's not zero. Now, if the system goes superconducting, it changes a little bit, and this change would have some kind of non-trivial form. In the case of D-wave pairing, it would have zero at the origin and some finite value elsewhere. If it's S-wave pairing, it would have its maximum over here and then decay. The difference. We'll come back to this one at the end, actually. Now, the story of the C-axis kinetic energy is strongly connected to the notion of holons and spinons, but I'm not going to do that now. The main point there was made by Phil Anderson that the gain in kinetic energy in the C direction would be just measurable as the Josephson coupling energy between the planes. And there's many ways in which you can determine this Josephson coupling energy. For example, you can do a penetration depth measurement, or you can measure the Josephson plasma resonance frequency or other things. There's a small caveat here. It's not a very important one, I think. Namely, this determination of the kinetic energy would only give you an upper bound to what the gain in kinetic energy could possibly be in superconducting state. And that's because some of the, never mind, this has to do with spectral waves, never mind. It's only an upper bound, just keep that in mind. Now, what we actually do in this case to find the upper bound is we use the plasma resonance phenomenon. Plasma resonance can be understood extremely simply. If you have superconducting layers coupled by a dielectric and some weak Josephson tunneling between them, then that system can be thought of as a lumped circuit system, lumped circuit element system, where you have capacitors, which are just the planes, in parallel with inductances, where the inductances are actually inversely proportional to the Josephson coupling energy itself, so it gives a certain inertial mass to the Cooper pairs. And solving this together, you get the Josephson formula for the Josephson plasma resonance. So that is 2e squared over h bar squared times ej over c. Now, c is something that we know is a geometrical factor, so we can just measure the distance between the planes and we can just calculate that number. And that means that by measuring this plasma resonance frequency, we can immediately write down, quite simply, what this Josephson coupling energy will be.
And you've got to make some assumption on dielectric.
More than an assumption, of course. We can measure that, too, from the optical spectra. So you have two ways of things you can measure and compare. And, a little bit more about how we measure this Josephson plasma resonance. In the optical properties, you are sensitive to the dielectric function and the optical conductivity. In the optical conductivity directly, there is no signature of this resonance, and that's because the optical conductivity corresponds to the transverse current-current correlation function. It's transverse, and that means that there is no direct coupling to charge density oscillations there, which are longitudinal oscillations. But you find it back in the real part of the dielectric function, which has a zero crossing right at this longitudinal frequency. And if we plot our optical data as a loss function, for example, it would look like a peak right at the plasma resonance. Not shown here, but if we measure reflectivity nicely with current, with fields parallel to the C direction of the material, this would look like a dip in the reflectivity directly. So I give you an example here where it was done. It's not the first measurement on LSCO, by the way. It was done by many others before us. But it puts together nicely what we have here. This is lanthanum strontium copper oxide, measured as a function of frequency. We have here the reflectivity. The reflectivity has some large structures at low frequencies, which are phonons. But below these largest, these relatively high frequency objects, we have in the superconducting state an additional dip, and that disappears as it goes normal. It's a nice and very striking demonstration of the existence of a Josephson plasma resonance. Now you can go through Kramers-Kronig analysis of this, and this way calculate this loss function I just talked about, and then you will find again a peak, of course, at exactly the same frequency. So after all, it's not necessary to do it to see what the resonance frequency. That's just there. But you can get a little bit more information just by looking at the loss function and studying the width of this thing, and that gives you the value actually of the quasi-particle conductivity, which is shunting the superconducting currents. So this is a demonstration of the effect. Here's another example of the same effect. This is Thalian 2201. This was not exactly the same geometry. Again, it is a reflection experiment, but again we see a nice dip here at very low temperatures where the resonant frequency sits. This is somewhat below 1 terahertz, and if we raise temperature, this thing shifts down gradually and it disappears. It's gone, or it's outside the window of observation in any case, by the time we reach TC. Then we have other compounds, related ones, where we see the same frequency also. As I said, there are other ways of measuring this condensation, this Josephson coupling energy. A very nice one was done by Catherine Moeller. Using a scanning squid, she was able to make a map, a contour plot of the fields surrounding a Josephson vortex, a vortex that is penetrating between the planes, parallel to the planes, and it turns out that the width of the field distribution in this direction is the planes running this way. The width of the field distribution around the vortex corresponds directly to the C-axis penetration depth, and that again is directly related to the condensation energy, and we were able to do it on the same compound and match, and then we found that the two values for condensation energy were the same on the same compound. Not surprising, maybe, or maybe it was surprising then. Now here we have an overview of many of these Josephson coupling energies. I already say here delta EK, maybe you should be a little bit more careful here. It's really the upper limit that we have. So on the horizontal scale we have condensation energy estimated from specific heat experiments. Now maybe the estimates are not very precise, but this is also a log scale, so we don't have to be so precise anymore. Here we have in this direction the kinetic energy changes. Now there are some examples quite close which were noticed very early on by Phil Anderson. One of the reasons one of the first noticed that they were actually quite close, that gave really some good hopes for the interlayer tunneling mechanism. But then we had several other examples. This thallium example was far too low, really. Later on there was bismuth 2201 by Matsuda, which was even further down the main line. And then we have some disputes about this mercury 1201, depends on who you spoke. And this is Panagopoulos, and that is Moeller and Kirtley. Now, we shouldn't forget that these points are positioned here at the upper limit of what the change in kinetic energy can be. I stress it again. The reason why, well, becomes clear later on. This Josephson coupling energy, or this plasma resonance frequency that we found, is only a measure of the change in kinetic energy if the spectral weight, which is responsible for that resonance, is not present, is not present already at normal temperatures above TC at low frequencies. So there's an assumption here that this Josephson plasma resonance emerges at low temperatures out of the blue, literally, out of the blue part of the spectrum. And that's not conventional behavior. In BCS models, for example, this wouldn't happen, and you would have a Drude peak at low temperatures, and some of the spectral waves of the Drude peak would be transferred to a zero frequency peak in conductivity. And it's actually, this number that we have here is just the intensity of that zero frequency peak in the conductivity. So, on the other hand, Dmitry Basov has carefully studied the difference in low frequency spectral weight in the superconducting and the normal state, and he concluded that there is at least part of this intensity is really coming out of the blue. Maybe 30% or 40% is coming out of the blue, and that would really mean that there is some gain in kinetic energy in the C direction as the system goes superconducting. But in many of the cases shown here, that gain is orders of magnitude lower than what's required to let a system go superconducting. But still, you know, there's it provides some optimism for kinetic energy gain scenarios. Now, related to this kind of effects, I want to show you something. Well, it's a bit of a digression. It's not immediately relevant, I would say, for this kinetic energy story, but it's a sort of nice other thing that we made some recent progress in various ways. In so-called double-layer compounds, you would really expect, according to this model of this Jodensen coupling, that there would be two plasma modes. And I misplaced this. Now I'll show you first the results and then what the model was for this. Here we have such a compound. It's samarium, lanthanum, strontium, copper oxide. It's an T-star phase, which is really an alternation of two types of blocking layers between the copper-oxygen planes. So there's lanthanum, strontium, oxygen, and samarium oxygen alternating. And what these people found was in the experiments, and I should add, these experiments were done in a way that they only reflect the longitudinal modes again. They reflect directly these plasma modes. They found two peaks, omega JA and omega JB, which were only present below TC and were absent above TC. They shift nicely as a function of temperature. So these are two Jodensen plasma modes. Now, if you draw for that situation what the dielectric function would look like, it would mean that we have in the dielectric function a zero crossing here, and of course a pole at zero frequency. That's the London response. And then there's a second zero crossing, and because the zero crossing always have to go from negative left to positive right, it must mean that there isn't pole right in between. Just from the fact that they saw these two modes, you can already conclude that this pole should exist. But they were not sensitive to that pole. But there are other ways of doing that, for example, with single crystals. Now you can also, we did our homework a couple of years back to use this Jodensen model and calculate from that what the form of the dielectric function would be. In fact, the way it was done was using equations of motion technique. And maybe those of you who are interested in that part, we can talk about it more later. But if you do it, you find a formula for the dielectric function which is strikingly simple. It's just, is this one correct actually? Yeah. Epsilon itself has two zero crossings, omega J1, omega J2. There's a pole at zero frequency and then there's a pole at a frequency in between these two. And the position of the second pole depends on the relative volume fractions of Jodensen junction of type 1 and Jodensen junction of type 2 in this formula. We've recently extended that. It's not available yet as a preprint. Well, I have it with me. There is actually an additional term in the Hamiltonian that we didn't take into account here, and that turned out to be very important. And it has to do with the fact that in addition to the Coulomb forces, there are also dispersive forces. And these dispersive forces have to do with the fact if you compress electrons, that the compressibility is not infinite. And that has a very large effect. It's a very important term, not for the usual Jodensen plasma situation, but precisely here where we have two types of plasmas, it is very important. I'll give you a qualitative argument for that in a minute. In fact, you can see that this transparency quite nicely. So these two solutions that we talked about correspond to the situation where, the first longitudinal mode corresponds to the situation where only Jodensen junction of type 1 is oscillating and type 2 is silent. So we have currents flowing here and there, but no currents flowing here. It's just what equations of motion tell us. And the second one is vice versa. Then this mode that we had in between, the transverse one, corresponds to really to waves which are modulated along the plane direction now, but where we have the two types of Jodensen junctions running separately, both at the same time, simultaneously, but out of phase. That places it right in between. And then this is just a superconductor. That's not so important. Now, if you look at this second type of mode, you actually see that here we have an alternation of layers where the superfluid is compressed and decompressed. right? And that's something you only find in these kind of alternating Josephson junction layers. You don't have it in single-type Josephson junction layers. Now, here you can already see that this thing about compressibility of the electron gas comes in. It's important. And the nice thing is you can formulate everything just in terms of that compressibility and go through the equations of motion, and again you find a very simple formula with this different weight factors. Now, here we have measurements on a single crystal. That's very recent. This was independently from us, was done by Fujima and Uchida, slightly different composition. So there's now two papers underway, actually, to BRL, at the referees, on similar compounds reporting the same effect, namely the fact that in the loss function, again, you have these two peaks here. This is in the terahertz regime, and at low temperatures there's an additional peak in the transverse direction, and that's this transverse Josephson mode, that's the third one that we have. Now, if you look at these two peaks, this is a log scale, you find that these two have very different intensities. On a linear scale, it's hard to recognize even the second peak. And we were bothered by that. When we measured this 4 months back, we had already written the paper about the experimental observations telling that the model of Artem Tvetkov and myself was wrong because it predicted the wrong intensities of these peaks. The model was wrong because it did not take into account this compressibility effect. But if you do take it into account, you get a number out for the compressibility simply from measuring these two intensities. This compressibility has a one-to-one relation to density of states. Strange kind of density of states. Namely, this one, K compressibility times n squared, is dn d mu. This has dimensions of density of states. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with a Fermi liquid type of density of states. It's more general thermodynamical thing. This number we could get out directly from these intensities, and what we found is that it is of the order of 1 eV minus 1 per copper atom. And that's very close to values that Lorem and others get from specific heat by measuring gamma. I don't know what it means. I think one should be careful to conclude from this that high-TC superconductors are Fermi liquid. But the numbers turn out to be the same. It's intriguing that they are the same. Another example where you have these two plasmons, it has been widely debated, take this one, is YBCO. It's really what started us off in this direction. YBCO, the commutativity of YBCO has, in the middle of the phonon peaks, if you go in the superconducting state, has an additional peak over here. And again, this peak disappears as the system goes normal. Depends a bit on doping. This is underdoped. It goes away if you go under doping. And I've always thought that this second peak was, again, the second plasmon, or this transfer Josephson plasmon. It's also there if you go optimally doped and overdoped, except you find it at even higher frequency. This is optimally doped. In the superconducting state, there's extra intensity over here. It's very broad now. And if it's overdoped, it's weaker and maybe somewhat higher frequency again. So here it seems that maybe there is still a remnant of that second plasmon, but it's now so high in frequency, it's actually above the gap, that you can't use the language of Josephson plasmons anymore. It's not allowed in this case, and there's considerable broadening of this second electronic mode. Now, we have been talking about kinetic energy in the C direction.
So this can be interpreted as basically a crossover from Josephson coupling to more of a BCS superconductivity, whatever, along the C direction.
Yeah, I don't know the right theoretical framework for describing these very high frequency modes if they are not just interband transitions. They appear to be other than ordinary interband transitions. There's a high degree of non-Fermi liquidness in there. And there isn't...
The energetics that are...
I did, actually. Well, it depends on how you do it. So if I take the crude approach by just taking the Josephson coupling energies needed, and compared to condensation energy, it's all fine. But if I do, so it's the same as the condensation energy. On the other hand, all that spectral weight that we find there is accounted for in the low frequency part of the by the opening of the gap itself. In all means better than 90%. Now, what is this thing about the kinetic energy in connection to what we said earlier? If you have a Fermi liquid, then there's always a step at the Fermi energy in this occupation factor as a function of energy. And as the system goes superconducting, this thing will always broaden. It has to be of this form. And you can see from comparing these two that no matter what, if the system goes superconducting, there should always be an increase in kinetic energy in if the system starts from a Fermi liquid. Should always go up. Now we've just seen now in the case of the C direction that there are some indications that it is going the wrong direction, although the intensity wasn't, I mean, the effect was too small, so it was opposite to this. So that scenario would be more like indicated over here. The normal state would not be a Fermi liquid then. Then you can infer it from there even. It has to be smooth over here and just becomes steeper as you go superconducting. Of course, even if it's a non-Fermi liquid, it's still possible that the superconducting state would be less steep than the normal state. But there you have both possibilities as a scenario. Now, for the C direction, we used implicitly a formula that makes a direct relation between the kinetic energy and the low frequency spectral weight. That is the integrated conductivity. In this case, we were just talking about the spectral weight contained in the delta function peak at zero frequency. Of course, conductivity contains more terms, contains more frequencies than just the zero frequency spectral weight. So you can generalize this thing and say, well, there's a one-to-one relation between kinetic energy here and the low frequency integrated optical conductivity, and then there's some universal prefactors.
What is V sub
U? Unit cell volume.
Oh.
This, by the way, is completely based on the assumption of a nearest neighbor tight binding model. It's not there at all if you have free electrons, and it can even have opposite sign if you have dispersions other than dispersion of nearest neighbor tight binding models. So one should be very careful with this. I'm not 100% convinced it's even applicable in the ITCs, in the C direction. In the in-plane direction it's better actually, because in the in-plane direction it seems that we can model reasonably well the dispersion of the electrons with a tight binding type model. Now there's a second thing, and we're going to use that later on. You can use Cramer's chronic relations to prove that for high frequencies this kinetic energy itself is actually related to the real part of the dielectric function, because there are Cramer's chronic relations connecting the real part of the dielectric function to the real part of the optical conductivity. So, to do the spectral weight analysis carefully in the in-plane direction as a function of temperature, that means careful enough to be able to, you know, to be sensitive to changes in kinetic energy, the kind of thing that we're looking for, is, I would say, it's experimentally impossible. It's just impossible. The reason is that the amount of kinetic energy that you have there is so tremendously large that by going through the usual Cramer's chronic analysis and integrating things, integrating spectra and then comparing different temperatures, you usually get error bars of the order of 5%, whereas the effect that we are hoping to observe is of the order of 0.1%. It's impossible. On the other hand, if you do it this way, you let nature do the Cramer's chronic, you let nature do the spectral weight integration for you. But of course, it's based on there's still this assumption of tight binding that could spoil the game. Nevertheless, that's what we try.
You have two.
Oh, no. One of them. That's why I brought this.
And I guess you assume a single orbital beside or something. How about interband transitions?
This is assuming that you are sufficiently far above the Drude peak, or in the tail of the Drude peak, possibly, but still below the interband transitions. Yeah, there's a lot of things going in there. And we will see actually from the data that there is a problem of that kind. We did it on YBCO, this is YBCO. We did the in-plane direction, and the technique used here was ellipsometry. I'll show you the full data in a minute, but I'll start with these examples. Because we just have seen this direct relation between epsilon 1 and kinetic energy, right? And what we actually were anticipating was in a non-BCS scenario, in the in-plane direction, that we would see a departure from the trend in kinetic energy to the lower direction if you go superconducting. And because kinetic energy and epsilon are related directly to each other, there's no sign change also, it's the same thing. You can just look directly at our epsilon 1 as a function of temperature plus, and really carefully, and see whether there is a break in this direction or in that direction. Now, ellipsometry, the thing that provides you directly, I think, called psi and delta, that's psi and delta on the top, but you can calculate from that an epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. So this one is directly proportional to sigma again, and this is the real part of the dielectric function. Now, I have more convincing examples than this one, actually. But what you see here at a frequency of 10,000 wave numbers, so that's more than 1 electron volt, that the imaginary part of epsilon, the absorption, really has a nice departure from the trend in the normal state as it goes superconducting. It's very clear here. The blue curve is just a fit, a polynomial fit to the behavior at higher temperatures. The real part of epsilon, if you would not have the blue line here, you would, with some luck, be able to see that there's a small kink over here. And in the general review that we overview of curves that we'll show in a minute, you'll see many more examples where it happens. But so there is a departure from this trend, but it departs in the upward direction and not in the downward direction. This is an improvement over what I showed in the summer, in Trieste, you were there. Then we had much bigger error bars. This thing has been oscillating over the past year. Initially I thought it was departing in the upward direction. In Trieste I thought the error bars were too large, but even within these large error bars it looked as if it were going down more than up. But now we have improved it, and it really looks as if it's going up now.
Sorry, what's the blue line again?
That's the polynomial fit to behavior above TC.
Just above.
Yeah. Now, it's much better sometimes to look at the data directly and without any fits. First of all, I showed you only one frequency. Here we have the dielectric function, real and imaginary part of many frequencies at different temperatures. This one is 4 Kelvin, the green one, and the dark blue one is 300 Kelvin. So there are temperature dependence, but you can see that they are quite small. And what we have seen a second ago was an enormous enhancement of the scale by 1,000. Here we have the detailed temperature dependencies. There are about 100 points in here for each of these different frequencies in the spectrum, real part and imaginary part of epsilon. And also on this scale, it's still impossible to decide that there's anything special going on at TC. So you have to enhance the scale really a lot in order to see it. And that's a technological challenge to be able to do this. I mean, there's a lot of experimental stuff in here that I didn't talk about, but it wasn't easy. But now we can do it routinely. Here we have the same graph, or one of these is the same graph that I showed you before. I think it's this one, right? Now there's no fit in it anymore. But anyways, if you look at some of these examples, especially as it here, for example, you see quite clearly that there's a sort of a kink, that there's really a departure going up from the normal state behavior. Much more clear is the effect in the imaginary part of epsilon. This is between 6,000 and 40,000. Here we are from 14,000 up to 22,000. This one is getting very clear now, right? It's a kink that's in the upward direction. Now, there are various ways of analyzing this kink.
I mean, the alpha behavior seems to be a bit irregular, right? It's functional frequency.
You'll get the grand view in a minute, and then we can talk about that. Here we have another example, different frequency. There are two ways of analyzing these data. One is that you take this polynomial fit into normal state and just measure the difference here. right? And that's what I'm going to plot soon in an overview plot, all these differences for both types of experiment. And there's another thing that you can do, and that is by measuring as carefully as you can the value of the kink. And you do it by fitting this part of the spectrum and that part of the spectrum separately while keeping the cross section at over here and measuring the changes, the change in slope at that point. That's what we did. So you get fits looking like this. So we have one slope here and another slope there. And then now, of course, it looks more convincing that there is a kink from this way. In fact, we used a quadratic fit on both sides. And putting all these things together, we get this overview plot. This is the first type of analysis where we, the second type, where we measured the change in slope at the phase transition, delta epsilon 1, delta epsilon 2, as a function of wave number now. You've seen already that, we have noticed already that this departure from the normal state behavior was always in the upper direction. But there's a bit of structure here, and you may wonder whether this dip has anything to do with an interband transition or not. I'm not sure. Another thing that you notice right away is it seems to be going up over here. Maybe I should show you the second type of analysis at the same time to convince you that it is not just our imagination. Here's the second type of analysis where we just took the extrapolation at a normal state and took the difference between that extrapolation and the low temperature 4 Kelvin data, and they look roughly the same as the other one. Again, seems to go up a little bit at this side here, and there's a bit of a dip over here, and then it drops and it saturates at zero above 2.5 electron volt or 2000 wave numbers, whereas the delta epsilon 2 is negative at this side and positive at that side. You see also that at lower frequencies these two types of analysis do not give the same result for epsilon 2, but I didn't say too much about that so far. Now what's also shown are solid curves here, which are simultaneous fits to delta epsilon 1 and delta epsilon 2 with a small number of parameters. It's a way of establishing that you're not looking at some funny artifact. These two curves should still be Kramers-Kronig related. And if you can make a fit with a small number of parameters, just two oscillators essentially, then it turns out, without doing the actual Kramers-Kronig analysis, that they are Kramers-Kronig related and they are not artifacts of our experiment and analysis. It also tells you something else, namely this curve here. In order to get this curve here, we had to assume that there was a reduction of spectral weight at zero frequency, not an increase. That means that we had to assume that the kinetic energy was behaving according to BCS model. And even with more or less the right magnitude. Now,
is this kinetic energy in the C direction?
No, we're talking now about the in-plane direction. Yeah, it's all in-plane direction. Not all. In the last part about the ellipsometry was in-plane direction.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, I was told to speak for not more than 1 hour, right? So is it all right to have 5 minutes and talk about the Coulomb energy? There's this more information in these data than only this. I already pointed out that all the effects seem to be over at frequencies above 2 electron volt. But that is, I mean, if you would think of an energy scale, you would say it's probably related to the plasma resonance frequency in the in-plane direction. That's 1.5 EV. It's a bit above that, but that's fine because, you know, there's no reason why it would stop there. I really have absolutely no idea why this would be the case, by the way. I mean, that's what I hope to learn sooner or later from talking to theoreticians. But Leggett did make some statements about Coulomb energy which are quite interesting. He said Coulomb energy, if that is the lowering for the if the mechanism of superconductivity would be a lowering of Coulomb energy, again, we can measure part of that. In fact, you can measure all of it if you really want, but not with optics. With optics you can measure part of it. Namely, with optics you're able to measure the change of Coulomb energy for two particles moving in the same plane for small k parallel to the plane. the reason that we can do this for two particles moving in the same plane in this case is because the superconductors, high TC superconductors, have such weak coupling in the C direction, so they are more or less independent planes. And within that assumption, it is possible to write down an expression which I worked out together with Tony Leggett this 2 months ago. It's proportional to the imaginary part of the square root of epsilon parallel to the plane minus 1 over the square root of epsilon parallel to the plane. The original formula by Mergier was simpler. That's for a three-dimensional electron gas, where you have the imaginary part of minus 1 over epsilon. It had to be adopted to the two-dimensional case now. But anyway, yeah?
So the characteristic momentum is like the wavelength of photon, right?
Yeah, in our case we are in our case we are confined to that wavelength, which is extremely small, long. The wavelength is long, yeah. If you would want to do this more generally, it's possible, not right now with the kind of accuracy that we have, but the way to go would be to do big machine physics, to do high energy electron energy loss spectroscopy with high precision. And it's one of my aims. I want to do that in the future, but it means rebuilding Jörg Finks's experiment with higher accuracy than he has right now.
That's a good sense of mass momentum, right? This is relative momentum losses.
This is the relative momentum. Now, so what we could just do is take the same data as I have shown before and calculate, using that formula for the Coulomb energy, delta E Coulomb. It's the same data. It's the same as epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 again. We just convert it with this square root of epsilon minus 1 over square root of epsilon formula to get delta epsilon Coulomb for small values of k and for two particles in the same plane. For different photon energies here, we have to add up all these curves to get the integral over all photon energies and then multiply with the appropriate prefactors and so. And you actually see that there is an increase in Coulomb energy for photons below the plasma resonance, and there's a decrease of the same number for photons above the plasma resonance. And the grand sum of these curves within the window that we have is something that is negative and quite small. It's minus 50 microelectron volts. It should be compared to a 400 microelectron volts per unit cell for copper, oxygen, for YBCO. So it's smaller, but in any case, it's roughly consistent with this notion that you have some gain of Coulomb energy, although I can't say I understand why, actually. That's what we measure.
Just to get a feeling, I mean, length scale is much larger than the coherence length, right? And I could sort of imagine that when your distance is much larger than the coherence length, you start to lose all information about what that force is bearing.
Well, also in the following transparency. What I've done here is take BCS theory and calculate, within the context of BCS theory, the behavior of the correlation function, the change in correlation function as the system goes superconducting, for two scenarios, D wave and S wave. This is this momentum that we were talking about. The width of this peak depends on various factors. It saturates at high values of k at zero. It has a maximum at zero k, actually. So it keeps rising. See, initially I thought also that for length scales smaller than the coherence lengths, you would not have any effects anymore. It's not true. It keeps rising. The point is that the coherence length enters in direct space. That's a sort of Gaussian envelope. And it's not really Gaussian, but anyway, it's peaked. If you do the Fourier transform into k-space, it's still peaked at zero frequency. The Fourier transform of a Gaussian is still a Gaussian. It has to peak at the same position, right? And that's why it's peaked here, and also it's peaked at zero, at position zero in direct space. The length scale determining the width here involves both the coherence lengths and lattice constants. There's a lot of stuff in there, actually. For D-wave symmetry, you actually find from BCS theory that the change in correlation function is positive at the origin of in k-space and is negative near the zone boundary. And if you integrate this curve, it's precisely zero. So you can take this curve, Fourier transform into direct space, and get a picture of the correlation function in direct space based on BCSE. By the way, the ingredients that I used were just well, a sort of tight binding mold that people use for the band structure, and either a D or an S wave type of gap. In direct space, it looks like this. Funny enough, this is for the S wave case. You have a big maximum at zero distance on the same side, and then drops very quickly. Again, there is a sort of length scale, which is now directly the coherence length, but there is also a length scale involved, which is the lattice parameter itself that makes it look so strange. In the case of D-wave pairing, this picture gives you precisely zero at the origin, must be, of course, for D-wave pairing. It has a maximum on nearest neighbor sides, and then it drops again quickly, not precisely to zero, but quickly to zero. And the funny thing about this is, it seems to tell you, you know, what essentially I did is I just took photo emission data, or band structure that has been fitted to photo emission data. I took the gap as a function of k from photo emission data and combined these two pieces of information to calculate the change of correlation function, but still adopting BCS as the model. And then that tells you directly, so this is in a way an experimental result that tells us what the correlation function in direct space is, and it tells us that the correlation function in the case of the coupe rates is highly peaked on nearest neighbor sites. Now, if you remember this formula for the total gain in potential energy, it was just the product of potential versus distance times this correlation function versus distance integrated over all space coordinates. You see immediately that the best kind of interaction would be a nearest neighbor attractive interaction. You can even get out a number. You need something like 0.2 EV to get the right TC this way. But this is still all based on BCS, and I mean, that's a weak point, of course. Now, that brings me to the end of the talk. You have seen that the Coulomb correlation energy changes a little bit for small k. It changes actually into a negative direction. There's a minus sign here. It's minus 5 microelectron volts.
Depends about the bottom line of this is that you are actually quite sensitive to, because you're looking at small k,
yeah.
And according to your correlation function plot, that correlation.
I should have said that. Yeah, so in our correlation plot, we are working in k space. And what we were just seeing in k space was this point here going up. In fact, what we were seeing was the product of this correlation function times the interaction potential. And apparently, the outcome of this experiment would indicate that the effective interaction that we have at this point, k equals 0, is slightly in a negative direction. It's strange somehow. I don't know what to say about that. Because it's also based on the assumption of Coulomb, which probably means that the screened Coulomb is really doing the work here. But the screening is slightly over-screening. Let me see. Then we have seen that the out-of-plane kinetic energy change in many single-layer coupe rates is between a nano-electron volt and 1 millielectron volt, sometimes in close to the condensation energy, but in some other cases orders of magnitude below that. Then we have seen that there are two Josephson plasmons in the bilayer materials. But it doesn't save the story of the kinetic energy in the C direction, I think. And then we have seen that the in-plane kinetic energy change in YBCO is probably larger than zero. It's really larger than zero. That means that it points more in the direction of a more conventional picture, but probably still could still be electronic, but more conventional in terms of sign of change of kinetic energy and interaction energy. Thank you for your attention.
So this last result is for optimally go YBCO?
Yeah.
Okay. Obvious question is, you going to do underdoped?
We have done underdoped. Not YBCO, but BISCO.
So what do you find there?
Well, something that we don't dare to publish. The problem is we find an effect there very like what we see in YBCO at a different temperature. I mean, we're talking about a 60 Kelvin superconductor, BISCO. But we see the effect at 80 Kelvin. With 65 for TC, at 80 Kelvin, we see the kink in the same direction as YBCO. Yeah. And we have done various checks. I mean, the crystals were really nice crystals. They were homogeneous. They had very narrow phase transitions. They were very carefully done by Peter Kess, who makes a big story about how good they are. Apparently, they have a very special procedure to get really sharp phase transitions at 65 Kelvin there. So they're uniform. We've done all kinds of checks to figure out that this could maybe a surface effect, you know, that the outer layer had a higher TC. But it's easy to check that. You just peel off one outer layer and you repeat the experiment and it looks the same.
Yeah. This goal is much more two-dimensional, so you may expect some cluster style as that.
Yeah. That's what I guess that's going on.
But you don't see this happening at the spin gap, that P-bar.
Well, that series of experiments was confined to the region 150 and 10 Kelvin. In the meantime, so that was done half a year ago. In the meantime, we can actually, for some technical reason, we couldn't go above 150 Kelvin without readjusting the cryostat. Now we can do it in a single run, but we haven't done it yet.
That what is T-star?
65, well, probably 200 Kelvin or so. I mean, it's way above this 80 Kelvin in any case.
Mm-hmm. All of this depends very much on this low-frequency extrapolation, right?
Well, we had these two ways of analyzing. The one where you compare the extrapolation to the value at zero temperature depends strongly on the extrapolation. But the second type of analysis, which involves taking the Richter's coefficient and the Richter's coefficient, that is another word. The angle of the curves above and below gives the same result, and that's not sensitive to the extrapolation at all. Okay. The slope. Yeah. Okay. English is much more complex than Dutch. We have two words for it. So this is the slope thing. All we did here is just take a parabolic fit to this part of the spectrum, and another parabolic fit to this part of the spectrum, forcing the two points to go to this point.
Isn't measured at 16,000 wave numbers.
Yeah.
You really get information about
them. Yeah, we use high frequency information to get insight in the low frequency spectral rate. And the argument there is that it's all based on this argument that the high frequency dielectric constant is particularly sensitive to the integrated low-frequency spectral rate.
So when you take some mole of the guy next to this dude saying there's some oscillator out there, he's quite broad, and it could also react to TC or whatever, would you get at the end of the day the same answer? Or?
Well, that is precisely what we did. When I showed you this fit, but you would get the same answer, roughly the same answer. And I showed you this fit, which I can't find anymore. So, here. One more possibly, here, yeah. Okay, the two fits here, but the purple curve here was actually not to a delta function at zero frequency, but to something that has a finite width, where the width was adjusted to make the fit work simultaneously in epsilon 2 and epsilon 1. Yeah, so it's in there. But nevertheless,
have you seen the formula for this kinetic energy? The formula for basing on this
one?
Yeah,
that's back.
Let's move it back here. The lower one, yeah?
Yeah.
Limit
as omega goes to infinity.
This
becomes. No one assumes that sigma of x has become smaller when in the frequency range you're looking at.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Is that the case?
It is actually the case, yeah. I mean, sigma 1 has dropped by 2 or 3 orders of magnitude, no more, 3 or 4 orders of magnitude at these frequencies. Yeah.
Is that the same as saying that epsilon is going like 1 over omega squared, or at least the temperature-dependent part is going like 1 over omega squared?
Well, it's the same thing, yeah.
And
but it's saying that, that at high frequencies you go as 1 over omega squared. Yeah.
Why not exponential?
But, well, you can see it from this formula here. Suppose that sigma is a delta function at zero frequency. You get 1 over omega squared right away.
What's the
secret?
I mean, it isn't really the limit as omega goes to infinity.
Oh, that's true. That is why, I mean, this is a argument to make it more or less plausible. To do it really quantitatively, we did make a fit. We just fitted this to a low frequency peak. But from, I mean, if your epsilon 2 is going up at this site, of course you would like to go lower in frequency, we are working on that. You simply don't have the kind of precision in this frequency range that we have in the high frequency range. It's more difficult technically in the infrared. But so there we have error bars which are really like this at the moment, and we have to reduce it first. But either we need one more oscillator in between, which is quite sharp, to cause this to let it turn around and go negative. And there's very little indication of that actually, of such an oscillator. If it would exist, people would have noticed, I would say. Everything is very smooth in the medium for that.
But in fact, your epsilon 2 is still quite large here. You still have a lot of absorption out here. And the amazing thing is that it's sensitive.
It's delta epsilon 2.
Yeah.
And it's small. It's 0.02.
Yeah, but it's amazing that it's there at all. At these high frequencies, there is no about the superconductivity, to me.
Yeah.
You could say that this disappears even at the plasma frequency. You could suggest that it's disappearing at the Mach-Hubbard gap. Mm-hmm. About 2 volts is close to the Mach-Hubbard gap.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, that's maybe another possibility. Yeah, and
so what I'm trying to think about is what, what the implications of what Doug said are. Is that the
so-called exchange interaction is actually kinetic energy. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. And
that comes from around the energy involved with something like the Mach-Hubbard gap.
Would that give you this sign? Yeah, probably, yeah.
I don't know
whether
it would give you the sign or the other sign.
Could have some, yeah.
I guess I thought it would give you the other sign. I thought it would give you the other sign.
Uh-huh. Well, that, I think we have to sit down with a piece of paper to see what it really says.
Certainly what Patrick's saying, too, is a surprise to me. Here you are up in electron volts, and you're being able to pick this up.
Yeah, we've seen it's literally changing color in the optical dark spectrum as it goes superconducting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It, but it's a change by less than 1%.
Hirsch, a long time ago, wrote a paper. Why should superconductors change color?
Right, it's that type. Yeah. Unfortunately, we have the wrong sign for Hirsch.
Well,
otherwise, yeah.
But in the end, if you go to higher frequencies, you turn into the real burial theory.
Yeah.
All that energy is
output.
So,
the
kinetic and potential energy is
output. Yeah, there's a factor
too. Did Bill Little at one time have some data up in this regime?
Right.
He was talking about the change.
I didn't take those transparencies. They, what we could do is take our data, and he was doing a thermal reflectance experiment, so differential reflectance experiments. He's still doing it actually, and it's possible to take our data and calculate delta of R at different frequencies and compare directly to what he measures, and that agrees very well. Very well. But then a bit in detail, it is not exactly. I think we can do it more detailed now. He has all kinds of sharp structure in there.
Yeah, I remember he was...
Well, recently we had that sharp structure, but now we are doing the experiments better and the sharp structure disappears. So the sharp structure that we found initially was just noise. Yeah.
I think he wanted at that time, as I remember, to interpret this as exotic mechanism and so forth.
Yeah, half a year ago I would have said the same, but it disappears if you measure longer, so it's probably not too much more. Yeah. This, by the way, is right at the plasmon. So there seems to be some coupling of plasmons involved. But maybe that's even what you would expect from Mott Hubbard stories also. Mott Hubbard would give
you that. Yeah, somehow now this plasmon at 1.5 eV knows that it's not superconducting.
Yeah, but that's not totally unexpected. If your kinetic energy changes, you change the spectral weight, that's going to change the plasma frequency. So these things do shift a bit.
Goes on up to 2 electron volts and then it disappears with a hot even higher.
Yeah.
It's very freely in the asymptotic region.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah. You would say that even at in the visible part of the spectrum there should be some effect. Yeah, but the spectral weight at very high frequencies asymptotically should be precisely constant. If you're above all the interband transitions. Right. Yeah, because then you have the usual F-sum rule and you're not changing the number of electrons in your system.
You're extrapolating the high frequency, but not too high frequency.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's...
So you always talk about changing kinetic energy or like at zero, or like plasma energy at zero temperature. Can you do some kind of temperature dependence and compare it to specific heat?
We can. We haven't. We have the data. We have not done that type of analysis yet. Yeah. But we can certainly. We have all these temperature points as you saw. In a way, it's getting better if you're closer to TC. Maybe there's indirectly some information already from these two types of analysis. The ones where you compare the kinks at this point gives you the information on spectral weight change close to TC, and the other one where you compare the extrapolation at low frequencies to the actually measured value tells you what happens at T equals zero. The two curves were close, but they were not identical, so maybe there is some real temperature-dependent information in there. Yeah. But we have still to do that.
But also the temperature dependence is very different for optimally doped or underdoped. So
sure. Yeah.
You would see that the effect, let's say it's not exactly nearest neighbor model.
Yeah.
Then that gives a 15% or 20% correction to that formula you wrote relating kinetic energy to asymptotic behavior, but you say this is robust, in this
yeah, except if the sign
says that we don't know, plus or minus 15% or 20%.
Yeah, except if you would go so far away from tight binding that the sign would even change. Yeah. That is in principle
that's what
possible.
I'm asking, you can estimate this correction.
Well, can we? I'm not with 100% confidence. I mean, how
just
reliable?
Just take the band structure value of T'.
Yeah, but what you should take is the experimental data, right? And the thing that I'm particularly concerned about is that the high density of states area in the photoemission data is near these difficult points, these hot spots. That's where the dispersion of bands isn't very well understood, or not at least not agreed upon by everybody. In fact, you don't have nice bands there.
Except that this formula does not depend on the because of what happens to the Fermi surface, it's integrated over all frequencies.
Yeah.
So you could just take the prime.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I haven't done it, but we should. Of course, yeah, we should try to do it. Yeah.
And I can't quite reconcile the story. I know that any minutes is running around this sort of a demise of tight binding models with regard to spectral weights in optics, right? Now, is Andy claiming a correction, or that it really doesn't make sense? Well, I was taught in my brain is that it's a serious problem.
I noticed that Andy is my roommate here. I haven't seen him today. I haven't talked to him about this so far, so that's what we should do. But maybe I can give you one bit of information that's useful. It also points out directly what the problem is with this tight binding model. The actual formula that you need for the low frequency spectral weight is can be written in this form. Low frequency spectral weight, we usually call it plasma frequency squared, is the summation over all k times n of k times the second derivative of energy with respect to k k squared.
So effective mass tensor, inverse mass tensor.
The inverse mass tensor, right. And only in nearest neighbor tight binding, this is directly, epsilon k is directly proportional to the second derivative, only in that case. On the other hand, well, what you need is just the inverse mass tensor at the Fermi energy. I do know, I do remember that there's no sign change there if you put in the T prime, so from that point of view it looks already safe. You need something really special to make to get a sign change, actually. It's quite difficult to do.
Okay, thank you very much.